Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating. The kids are back in school. Is that good? That's pretty good. Routine. You know they say like kids need routine. I need routine. The last 2 months, I've had no routine. I've had just constant trying to work and people saying, we do this, we do that. Can you take me here? Can you take me there? I think I'm just ready to ease into autumn. And I know everyone's complaining about the summer being over. I'm ready for it. I'm ready for it. Now, coming up in this week's pod, we're going to be talking to a guy called Steve Benner. He's a chemist and astrobiologist. And he's written this book that looks at data from the Viking missions in the 1970s. At the time, they were looking for life on Mars and they didn't find it. But that is not the full story, as we'll hear. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Fergus McAuliffe, Head of Research Engagement and Impact at Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, Lecturer in the School of Natural Sciences at the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Jessamine.
Whatever, I do what I want.
Is about our brains.
Not just our brains, but who's calling the shots in them? Like, are we making the decisions that we think we're making, and why? So this is based on a new paper by Professor Tom James from Indiana University about perception, the things that we perceive around us, and how we translate our perceptions into action. This is what's called decision-making. We're all familiar with it, even if we're not actively thinking about it as we make each and every decision in our day. And for a long time, decision-making has been treated as this sort of abstract process within cognitive science that is situated in lots of different brain regions. You know, we know different parts of the brain that are responsible for it, especially this part in the front that's called the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, which, you know, you can do brain scans, you can see it light up, all this kind of thing. But what Professor Tom James has proposed is that, in a way, decision-making is not as concrete as all that. It's not a thing that we can pin down on one sort of circuit in the brain necessarily. Whereas perception, you know, we have organs of perception. We have our eyes, we have ears, nose, our skin. We know when inputs are coming in, and then we're able to take action based on them, right? We're able to, like, kick a ball or open a door. We do muscular actions based off of those. But what's happening in between? The word decision-making is kind of being used to cover up a big, messy process that involves, you know, not just some parts of the brain, but also how we feel in our body, what's in our environment. You know, it's reductive in a way to try to break it down into, well, this molecule goes here and that one goes here, and that's why I'm making decisions. And so it's kind of a tricky concept to get your head around, is what I found while I was researching this story. This is coming down to what in philosophy is called a physicalist framework, that, like, everything comes down to materialism. It comes down to, like, what is physical and concrete and real in the world. And these sort of abstractions that don't have a concrete basis, it's not like they're not useful, right? Like, thinking about the process of making decisions is useful because we all need to make decisions all the time. But it isn't necessarily a linear thing where, you know, you get your inputs, you get your sensory inputs, you make your little, like, list of, like, yes, no, and then at the end you have a decision come out. For one, we don't mostly take that much thought with our decisions. You know, you might make that approach to a big decision, like, where am I going to go study? But you might not take that approach to, like, what am I going to have for breakfast? You might just grab a thing, do a thing, not really think about it.
So this guy is saying that we don't really make decisions, just things happen and we react to them? Or because don't we plan stuff? Because that thing of, this is where I might go to study and then I go study there. Surely that is, there's a consciousness there to make
that? Yeah, and it's not to say that there's no consciousness there making decisions, right? But it's kind of just saying that it's not as linear a process as all of this. There's stuff coming in, there's stuff going out all the time, and especially this is very focused on, like, the sensory aspect of things and the motor aspect of things. So not just thinking of your brain as this, like, disembodied thing that just is sort of making decisions for you. There's this really famous kind of dichotomy, which is called the Cartesian theater, and thinking about, you know, if you're trying to solve, well, how does the brain work? And your fundamental description of how the brain works is that you put a little guy in it who's making your decisions for you. It's like, well, you didn't really answer anything there. You just put you put another brain inside your brain, and you're like, that's it. That guy makes my decisions. And it's like, but who makes his decisions? And the gist of this paper is it's actually really hard to describe that. It's lots of interacting networks that are underlying something like decision making. Even if it feels to us like we are a discrete person that is making those decisions.
Yeah. And that, I mean, while that sounds like quite complex and abstract itself, that kind of makes sense to me because I wonder if you peel apart everything that we've seen, you know, wouldn't our anatomy have shown something, our understanding of the brain, wouldn't it have shown something in you know, functional brain scans or mm-hmm. that would have been really clear if there was some centralized decision-making
yeah.
part of our brain.
If there was a little guy pulling levers, we would know about yeah. it by now, but it's a lot messier than that.
Fergus, our second story has to do with swimming, which is something that you do, and I do very briefly.
Yeah, while swimming.
Yeah.
So this is something I try and do every week. Obviously, since COVID, it experienced a massive boom. Loads of people are doing it. People extol the benefits of while swimming, both for the physical health and mental health. And we even know, so there's been really nice studies that have been comparing if you were to swim in the sea or a river versus, say, an open air swimming pool, you still get a benefit, kind of the more wild it is, if that makes sense. However, while swimming still has some risks associated, especially depending on how clean the water is. So we'll all be familiar with, you know, there's heavy rain showers and then the following day the county councils are putting out warnings saying, listen, don't swim in the sea for the next 3 or 4 days. Hmm. So this is actually quite an unusual study for while swimming because it's not observational. So most studies on recreation and the outdoors are kind of observing what people are already doing, whereas this one that came out of the University of East Anglia was actually a controlled study. So they had 2,300 people in Hungary who signed up to take part, and they brought them to two swimming spots, a river and a lake. Half of the people then swam in that river or the lake for at least 10 minutes and put their heads under the water at least 3 times. The other half, the unfortunate half, just got to watch from the shore. They never got wet. In parallel, they were testing for E. coli and a few other bacteria and viruses that are associated with fecal contamination. And then 1 week later, they asked people, have they experienced any symptoms of gastrointestinal illness?
Right.
When it came to the physical symptoms, so diarrhea and vomiting and nausea, there wasn't that much of a difference between swimmers and non-swimmers. So 2.1% of swimmers got sick, about 1.9% of non-swimmers got sick.
Right.
But that was at sort of low levels of fecal contamination. The higher the levels of the fecal contamination, the greater the difference between those two control groups became. But actually, the really interesting part was when they looked at rashes and ulcers and itching on the skin, that's where the biggest difference was. So 2.7% of swimmers experienced issues with their skin, less than half that for the non-swimmers.
Right.
So clearly there is something happening in the water. What they also found was that it's not due to the fecal contamination. They think it's due to something else. They've posited that it could be due to what's called carcinical dermatitis, the lovely avian parasites that are actually burrowing down into your skin and you only pick them up, say, from swimming in the water, and that appears to be what is causing this increased incidence in the swimmers versus the non-swimmers. A big take-home for me in this is even though there was fecal contamination there, they all passed bathing water standards.
Mm,
so even in the cleanest waters, there are still issues there. So that old adage of if you swim in the Liffey or the Riverlea or whatever it is and you have the soft drink on the way out of the swim, just to flush things through the stomach, it appears that there's something there for it.
Yeah, I mean, the way we sample water is so, it's so sporadic. To me, it's crazy how we get blue flag beaches and don't get blue flag beaches. But it's still, it's such a bugbear for me that we have these, you know, torrents of rain and then the entire bay is flooded with feces. And we don't have a long-term plan to fix it, at least, you know, not anything concrete. And it really does drive me mental. Our third story, Jess, has to do with depression.
That's right. And specifically the way that the brain does or doesn't make new neurons. So for a long time, the medical model of depression in terms of how this works, you know, at a cellular level in the brain was very focused on things like dopamine, sertraline, like getting enough of these chemicals that give us positive signals in the brain. And there's new research from Columbia University that's showing that there actually might be an element to this as well of where new neurons are actually showing up or not. Now, people, especially listening to this program, probably know that, you know, when you're born, when you're a little tiny baby, you have a huge number of neurons. You have 100 billion neurons, but you're also a little tiny baby. You're not very good at doing stuff. So you sort of flail around for a while. Over the first 10 years or so of your life, those connections are selectively pruned so that you get better at doing stuff, but you have fewer neurons. There are actually very few places in the brain as an adult where you make new neurons. You can change the connections between them, so the synapses. You can make new patterns. That's how, of course, we keep learning things. We keep forming memories. But one of the only places in the brain that forms new neurons when you're an adult is the hippocampus. So the hippocampus, this little kind of piece in the middle of the brain that's involved in memory, involved in emotion. This new research from Columbia has shown that actually, in people with major depressive disorder, one of the pieces of how that turns up at a cellular level in their brain is that new neurons are not being made as readily in the hippocampus. So what's called neurogenesis, the creation of these new neurons, is not happening at as high a rate. The way that they figured this out was pretty interesting. They basically took people who had recently died. They extracted the hippocampus in their brain, and they were looking, you know, you can't just look for which neurons are new, which ones aren't. They also looked for the stem cells that kind of come before you get these new neurons, and they looked for neuroblasts, kind of like proto-neurons. And they found that even though these brains had plenty of neural stem cells, they weren't converting into new neurons as much as would be expected from people without a major depressive disorders. So it's really interesting because, you know, the hippocampus has been looked at for depression for a long time, again, because it's so important to memory, so important to emotion.
Yeah.
And the theory that these researchers had has to do with pattern separation, which the hippocampus is known to be really important in. It's basically where you look at past and present events and also like your past and present emotional states. And are you able to separate those out from each other? You know, if you go to a restaurant one day, have a great experience, go to a restaurant another day, have a terrible experience, are you storing those things separately as they're encoded into memories in your brain? Or are you just like, man, that restaurant's always really bad? Like, and so being able to separate current events from past, especially past very negative or traumatic events, is one of the difficulties that many people with depression have. Now, this is kind of a tricky one in that depression, it's kind of like cancer. It's a big family of illnesses.
Yeah.
There can be lots of different molecular mechanisms. There are lots of different social and environmental factors around it. So it's not necessarily to say that, you know, every single person with depression would be having this sort of issue in their hippocampus or that a future therapy to target it would work for everybody.
But it's always interesting to find some sort of biology slash pathology that's associated with a particular, you know, condition or disease. Like to see that, you know, surely will tell us something about that condition and maybe useful for finding new therapies.
Absolutely.
But yeah, really interesting. Our final story, Fergus, has to do with microbes on the moon. What is this?
So this is all about leaving no trace. So as humans, we are natural explorers. And when we're going around hiking and mountaineering, we try not to leave any litter behind us. It's different in space. So to help us understand that, I want you to imagine a pencil, right? And the top, so the eraser or the rubber that's at the top of that pencil, if you imagine the surface area of that, and you imagine that that's now on your skin, that tiny patch has about a million microbes in it, okay? So when we as humans go into space, we are carrying those microbes as hitchhikers. And different to machines, we can't sterilize the astronauts that we send into space. So say, for instance, if we're putting a robot up there, they'll be heated to 300 or 400 degrees Celsius. You can't do that to a human.
Okay? No, you can't. And we need the microbes. We would be dead without microbes.
We would be dead without
the microbes. We need the microbes. It's a symbiotic relationship, right?
Exactly. In 2028-ish, or certainly by the end of the decade, there are talks of sending crewed missions back to the moon.
Yeah.
And ultimately, there's talks of establishing a base on the moon, on the lunar South Pole. As that base is being established, what NASA were really interested, and they're the authors of this study, they wanted to try and figure out is that if we were to encounter microbes on the South Lunar Pole, would they be there already or would we have brought them there?
Right.
Because one of the reasons that the base for humans is going to be at the South Pole is because of the angle that the sun hits it at. So if you imagine you have a table and you put a torch on the table and you turn it on, that's the same angle that the sun is hitting the lunar South Pole at.
Yeah.
There's lots of craters on the South Pole. Inside those craters, the sun never reaches. So they could be potential areas where microbes can survive in there. But if we're sending our sensors out and we're coming across these microbes, were they there already or have we brought them ourselves?
Mm.
So what NASA did is they took five common microbes that have been found on things like the International Space Station, all transported up from Earth. And then they essentially did a big computer simulation whereby...
Like Sims for bacteria.
For bacteria, exactly like that. They looked at how is the sunlight hitting the craters, how much UV is being experienced, what are the temperature highs and lows that are being experienced, and which of those microbes would survive. They then found this really nice phrase, survivability niches, essentially places where if we were to, by accident, leave microbes there, that they would be able to survive.
Yeah.
Just for one day, they wouldn't even be able to grow, but in theory, they could survive, these hitchhikers across the galaxy.
So one day is the maximum survival period, no matter what.
That's all they've gotten so far, yeah.
Okay, right. Well, that's pretty conclusive, isn't it? That's it from our news rounders. Thanks very much to Dr. Fergus McAuliffe and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Now, about 50 years ago, the Viking missions landed on Mars, becoming the first landers to carry out experiments on the surface of the Red Planet. And the conclusion reached from those experiments was that in all likelihood, there was no life on Mars. But was it a mistake? Could we have misinterpreted what Viking found? Stephen A. Benner is a chemist, astrobiologist, and author of Meet the Neighbours, Life on Mars and How to Find It. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Stephen. A provocative title for your book, given what we know. But tell me a little bit about this, because these Viking missions are very rarely talked about in public life. You know, they've seemed like very historical missions, but they were really important missions at the time.
Oh, absolutely. This is the first, and as it turned out, the last time that Homo sapiens, the human species, has made a deliberate effort to look for extant life on another planet. So there were two. They flew the mission in duplicate. So they landed at two sites. It was sort of the idea that if you one failed, the other would succeed. It turned out that both succeeded. Each of them had three different life detection experiments. Two of them were serious. One looked for what photosynthesis, like what the plant is doing on the over my right-hand shoulder, that looked for, they put radioactive carbon dioxide above the surface of Mars, and they look for the formation of radioactive plant material, basically what happens if I put radioactive carbon dioxide on a plant. They also did a second experiment, both sites in duplicate again, where they looked for what we call respiration or oxidative respiration. They fed the soil radioactive food, and they looked for the evolution of radioactive carbon dioxide, which is what would happen if I fed you radioactive food, or you would then exhale radioactive carbon dioxide after you had used the oxygen in the air to burn it. So in both cases, on both sites, both experiments saw positive results. They saw the fixation of carbon dioxide, about 1,000 cells worth of carbon was fixed into the soil, that we like to call in chemistry as a reduction process. It is removing oxygen for things. And then they saw roughly about the same amount of 1,000 cells worth, if you thought that the Martian cells looked like Earth cells, about 1,000 cells worth of respiration, of oxidative respiration, where they put oxygen back into things and then exhaled it from the surface. And at the time, you know, Robert Jastrow, who was then head of NASA's Goddard Space Center, said, hey, this is a case as strong as case for life on Mars as Viking could make it.
So pause there for 1 second. What you're saying there is these experiments, they released chemicals into the ground and measured what came back. And if there's any organic process of as you say, respiration or absorption, those chemicals that come back will be slightly different as a result of being consumed or breathed or whatever. How good were these experiments in terms of design? I mean, in terms of instrumentation and the setup and the calibration of these, if you got a result, how confident would you be of that, given we're talking 50 years ago?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, look, I mean, obviously from a 50 years perspective, we can be, as we like to say in America, Monday morning quarterbacks. The experiments were seriously designed. They were tested on the deserts in the high mountains of Chile, the Atacama Desert. They were tested in Antarctica, what they call the oxidative respiration experiment, where they fed radioactive food to the surface and looked for the surface to exhale carbon dioxide that was radioactive. That could detect down to 30 cells in the sample. As I said, it gave a signal corresponding to what you would expect for about 1,000 cells. The carbon fixation experiment, the photosynthesis experiment, that is the absorption of carbon dioxide out of the air to make organic material, that was less sensitive, but still your readership or listenership is not really versed in statistics, but there's three sigmas above background. So these were statistically significant signals. Now, no, this is a resource sparse environment. If you go to your backyard, you have billions upon billions of cells, okay, yeah. In an example. So what you're looking at here is the amount of density of cells that you do see in the high deserts of Chile or in Antarctic glaciers. So it's a relatively low amount of material, but the signals are, from a statistical perspective and from the point of view of experimental design, quite robust.
Okay. So you have this experiment. They also added water to the soil and so on. And they're basically, they're just trying to see, does this sort of stuff happen on the surface that you would typically see if there was any form of living cells or presence of something that might look like that? And as you say, Jastrow, who's head of this particular program, said, this looks pretty much like life. This is not the story that people are told. Why is that?
Yeah, well, so you got to put yourself back in the shoes of these people. Now, suppose you had gotten 3 or 4 affirmative life tests. Would you go out in front of a camera and say, hey, I've discovered life on Mars? Now, the answer you would be very slow to, because the last thing you want to do is what we call announce a false positive. We found life, and then you don't want some high school kid a week later looking at your data and say, wait a minute, you didn't see something.
Yeah.
So you would do what they did, which was poke under a rock, get a sample from under a rock, turn the light off when you're trying to do photosynthesis and do all sorts of controls. You would heat the sample maybe to kill what you think might be life in the sample. And what they saw was a bunch of tweaking and redoing of the experiment. All those data come back life consistent, at least, and many of them life affirmative. So now what do you do? Well, again, you don't want to go out and make an announcement and be caught wrong for a false positive. So what happened was another experiment came along, which was called a gas chromatography mass spectrometry experiment, GCMS for short. It's not terribly important to go into the details, but what it did was a look for organic molecules in the soil by taking a sample of soil and heating it up 500 degrees centigrade and looking for the organic vapors that come off of it, sort of like burnt popcorn, you can smell it, okay? So, and what they claim to have found was no organics. Now, that's not quite true. They did see organics. They saw small carbon-containing molecules with a few chlorine atoms in them. They did not understand them, and therefore they did what scientists always do when we get data that we don't understand. We have a tendency to sweep it under the table and to try to get, we don't understand it, so we have to discount it. These are what we call anomalies, and at some level, they're supposed to be the events that, cause you to re-examine your theory. So if they saw these, but they decided that they were not from Mars, that they had been brought from Earth. They did that despite the fact that they had tested that GCMS on the way out to Earth and hadn't seen the compounds. And so they concluded that the Martian soil contained no organic molecules.
What? Okay. So what you're saying is 50 years ago, a lander on Mars with the instrumentation that it had at the time, as best as it could, ticked almost every box as far as we can see today as having some form of organic-like, or at least that there is the reasonable expectation that if there was organic life, this is how we would see it. And yet, the next thing that happened was it just got thrown away.
Well, yeah. So I want your viewers to have some sympathy for the scientists, right? So when they came, they're not chemists. They came back, they saw the GC mass spec, GCMS, saying no organics. A guy named Jerry Soffin, who was running that mission, said, hey, that's the ball game. No organics, no life. That allowed them to come up with a reason to not declare they had found life with all the other experimental data. And so they decided that by a preponderance of evidence standard that there was no life on the surface of Mars. That was then, in the review article, data were shuffled around to try to make the data conform to that new interpretation. Then in 1977, a Scientific American article was written. Robert Jastrow kept saying, no, the GCMS is first not sensitive enough to detect organic chemicals in cells, only a few cells. In the year 2000, I had another look quite by accident at the data and published a paper explaining why the GCMS data had been misinterpreted. There are, by the way, organics all over the place on the surface of Mars. The rovers that NASA has put down there, Perseverance, Opportunity, are finding lots of organics. So by 2010, everybody who had any reason to know knew that the experiments had misinterpreted. Gil Levin, who had run the respiration experiment, said, and he returned to the field and he said, hey, well, wait a minute. If the GC mass spec has been misinterpreted, like Steve said, and if, you know, we know that we set the organics on fire in 1976, which is why we didn't see anything but their combustion products, why don't we go back to the status quo ante and say, let's revisit the problem of extant life on the surface of Mars? But science communities have a consensus, right? We used to think that ulcers were caused by spicy food and stress, right? And that there were billion-dollar drugs based on that paradigm. Well, ulcers are not caused by spicy food and stress. They're caused by bacteria. But the community will go down a direction. There's groupthink. There's collective.
I would get all that. I will also say that, you know, that line from Spider-Man holds true in science that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. You know, if you're with every, you know, massive claim, it needs to have massive evidence. And it's fair to say that the data that came from Viking, as limited as it was, doesn't rule out life, but it certainly doesn't prove life, right? And when we talk about organics that have been found, you know, by Perseverance and Curiosity, and I love the fact that, you know, that we think of Earth as this really interesting planet, but there's a planet in our solar system that's inhabited solely by robots. I love that. We have a robot populated planet. But those two rovers, they found organics, but organics makes it sound like we're talking about life. Can you just maybe help the audience understand where this line is between finding organics, finding what might look like respiratory action, and actually a living cell?
Right. Well, you won't hear the word proof come out of my mouth ever.
Yeah.
Proof is for mathematics. We don't do proof. And even NASA these says, well, there's no conclusive evidence. Well, conclusive evidence is how you end exploration. It's not how you begin explorations. If you have conclusive evidence, right, you don't explore. So keep in mind, just finding organics is not a very good biosignature, as you were basically saying.
Yeah.
You're quite correct, because organics are made without life as well. But what Viking did was actually a level better. And, you know, if I can get your listeners to understand this point, they'll know more than the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. What they saw on Mars was a biosphere incomplete. They looked at the fixation of carbon, which gives, on Earth, plants. And then you see the oxidation of carbon, which is what you as an animal do when you eat plants. So they're looking at a complete cycle and its chemical transformation, not the presence of an organic stuff in the soil, which could perhaps be made by non-biological processes. So what you're seeing here is, and it's a contradiction without life. So, right, people have gone back and tried to say, okay, yeah, they oxidize the food. That's what you do as a life form, but maybe there was an oxidant in the soil that would oxidize the food without life. But then the photosynthesis experiment is that they reduced carbon dioxide, which means that they take oxygen out of the material.
Mm.
And so maybe there is in the soil something that takes oxygen out of the material, which is what explains the photosynthesis result.
Right.
But now you have both in the soil a non-biological material, according to hypothesis, that removes oxygen from things. But in the same soil, you have, according to the non-life view, something that puts oxygen back in. And so all of a sudden, you're looking at incompatibility in this magical non-living system, which somehow is managing able to reduce carbon out of the air and then reoxidize the reduced material back into the air. That's something that the biosphere does, but it's actually hard to get both of those things in one sample.
I'm right. Okay. Having this information now, surely with Curiosity and Perseverance, we would have gotten samples that can give us much better accuracy as to what we're actually looking here. What sort of sampling instruments were on those rovers to look for these signs of organic life?
Yeah, well, yes and no. So there's no question that in 1999, when the NASA Astrobiology Institute was started, and I was one of the founding members of it, we were told that NASA would never send a mission to look for extant life because we had done this thing in Viking. It had been ambiguous or a problem. And the statement was that Viking had failed, right?
Wow.
And so no mission that was put together, not Spirit, not Opportunity, not Curiosity, not Perseverance, which is both of which are operating on Mars today, all of them were explicitly said to not carry payloads to look for extant life. You could look for water. You could look for past life. You could collect samples for sample return, which is what Perseverance has been doing. But because Viking was regarded as being a mistake and a failure, all of us in the Astrobiology Institute who were designing those experiments were explicitly told that we would not send any mission to Mars to look for extant life. And so it wasn't done.
Wow. And so it is possible that if we had put a scooper on Curiosity or Perseverance and actually tested for organic life, it is possible that it could have found it?
Absolutely. I mean, this I consider the mistaken interpretation from Viking percolated for 50 years into mission planning. And that percolation prevented follow-up experiments by explicit policy. They decided not to try to look for extant life because they thought that Viking had failed. And that belief that it had failed, of course, is based on the misinterpretation of a GCMS data.
So this is my memory from covering it live when these missions went up many years ago, is that they did not have a plan to collect this life. Is there any way we could now, given the sort of ambiguity of Viking data, is there any way we could get what we have from those two and do proper testing on it, or is it too late?
Well, we didn't get any samples back from Viking, so we can do on Earth some experiments here to add value to the data that we have gotten back. But Jan Spacek here, as there's called the International Rideshare Mars mission, it is possible now to deliver penetrators to the surface of Mars without the expense of a soft landing. You're going to drop things onto the surface of Mars. They have to be impact hardened. They will hit like a bunker busting bomb. But if we can get a ride from SpaceX, you can have thousands of these experiments go. They will cost maybe $40,000 to design and deliver one. Your Cub Scout troop could put together some bake sales and get local sponsorship to democratize, basically, search for life on Mars. So there are ways to go back to Mars relatively inexpensively, not with these many billion-dollar missions,
wow,
to try to follow up. And that's
on
the table.
Wouldn't that be so cool? A public-funded citizen science mission to try and find life on Mars.
Right,
that'd be
right.
So
well,
cool.
Exactly. And PressSpaceWorks.com, I think is what they call it, is taking solicitation. They're trying to gauge the interests. If we get it from enough people, we can go to Elon Musk or somebody and say, hey, how about giving us a ride?
God, it'd be great if he was useful for something good. But for now, Stephen A. Benner is author of Meet the Neighbors, Life on Mars and How to Find It. Really interesting, provocative read. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen.
Entirely my pleasure.
That was very interesting, but I like the journalist in me is sort of just a little, I feel like there's a lot being, even though I don't know the subject, right? I feel like there's a lot being read into the, I don't know. How do you feel about it? Like when
that's
you heard
funny.
That, I don't know. I wasn't fully convinced. Oh my God, we got, but maybe that's just because the opposite of that actually Viking in the 1970s actually did find life on Mars is such a way out there that my brain is like, I'm not willing to entertain that without more something.
It's funny because I have this sort of, I guess it probably, maybe it just comes down to your underlying attitude, because over the last, like, definitely the last 5 years of doing this show, just there's been loads of little bits of like evidence or pointers, no conclusive evidence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that has just made me go, oh, this is kind of a done deal. I feel like just people don't want to, like Stephen was saying, nobody wants to be the people to come out and go, right, I found it, and be caught out. But it feels very like, you know, especially with stuff that's been coming back from Perseverance, where they're like, oh, we found these, remember, we found those white spots, and the only way they ever happened on Earth is life, and we found these organics. And you know, they're not conclusive. Yeah, but they also point to this.
Everyone's afraid to say what's on their mind,
and that's the way they should be, like as scientists. But as a layperson, I don't have to do that. And I'm kind of going, I think they're almost there, and it's really frustrating. They don't have I mean, there's lots of probably more important things we could get annoyed at Donald Trump about. There are definitely, but he's also cancelled the collection of the samples from Mars, which is really annoying.
Because
you're like, well, it looks like they have these white circle things.
That's because the Illuminati told them, don't get rid of this evidence.
The lizard people.
I don't think we'll find organic. We might not anything living on Mars. I don't think we will.
Why do you not think that?
I don't know. It gets kind of hot. Gets kind of cold.
Yeah, but
I feel like we might find stuff that was there from before, but I don't feel like we'll find living things on Mars. I don't know. I just don't get the sense of it. Maybe it's because of all the narrative that we've given. We're constantly told what a desolate planet it is, and we see the photographs of it. It just looks like rock.
Yeah,
but I don't know. In my gut, but I've no evidence. But for it either way. But I feel like. You have to have a lot of really strong evidence.
I know you do, but like, you know that we found out that you can bring tardigrades and like other microbes to this International Space Station, put them outside for a few months, bring them back in, and they're still alive.
Yeah.
And then you see those old photos of Mars. I can't remember, it's like billions of years ago. It's like, and it looks like Earth. You know, they do these like computer generated before their atmosphere left them, and it's got probably a bit of water, a bit of green, if there was life there. And you're kind of going, well, if it was like that, whatever, 2 billion years ago, and we've seen that once stuff gets going, microbes seem to be able to survive just about anywhere, then it's not inconceivable that they would have just hung around. I don't think, anyway.
Yeah, I just don't think we're going to find life on Mars. I don't know why. I just don't think we're going to find. I think it's quite highly possible that we might. And I do fully believe there's life in the solar system. I mean, you'd have to be insane not to think there are aliens. But at the same time, saying that sentence out loud, people think you're insane if you think there's aliens. But like mathematically, there has to be aliens.
Yeah.
I would put people in two camps. Either you believe in aliens or you believe in a God and that we are the center of a creation by a magical being. There, you can't be in neither of those two camps.
I think you can be in both.
You could be in both, but you can't be in neither.
Yeah,
you probably have to either believe with the mathematical chances of this one planet in, it is impossible to keep going with the numbers of how many planets there are out there. Even just in our own solar system, in our own galaxy, there are trillions of planets, right? Which is a ridiculous amount of planets. And then we have just one tiny galaxy amongst the whole. So mathematically, you basically say humans are the only one. And if you believe that, you must believe that a spiritual, magical thing has happened.
Yeah, maybe, well, see, there is that, but there's also, it's funny because you only need like a I think people sometimes misinterpret that or don't understand that they'll be like, oh, well, what if we find microbes? That's not very interesting. But it's really interesting. It's like amazingly exciting because it just means if you go to the next one and there's microbes, then essentially the universe is awash with plants.
I don't buy that. I don't buy that. And I'll tell you why.
Life.
No, I don't buy that either. I do think it is possible within our solar system that a few species jumps, you know,
things
smashing into each other. I think it is theoretically possible because we're so close together. It is possible that we may find microbes on Mars that life came from Mars or vice versa. But I don't believe that you can believe that it's a mathematical fluke we're here. You have to believe it's spiritual or magical or whatever.
Well, it could be a fluke. Like, there are lots of gates to life, which we've discussed before. Like, there are lots of gates to get us where we are that are highly unlikely. The one that always comes to me is, I think it was Nick Lane originally said it to us, but the possibility of multicellular life only happened once, and it seems to have been an archaea just jumped into a bacteria and kablamo, you've got like multicell. So it happened once. So maybe it's so outrageously unlikely, you know, the odds are 1 in 25 trillion, then suddenly you're like, well,
1 in what? 1 in 10 to 20 to the power of 24?
Or 1 in You know, what I'm saying is it could be 1 in 10 to the power of something that's more than half the planets that we're aware of in even just our galaxy. And then suddenly life is actually very rare or possibly impossible elsewhere. But we don't know that. So that's why
there are at least 2 trillion galaxies.
Yeah.
Our galaxy has billions of stars, and each of those stars has planets.
Yes.
It's you either accept that it's a mathematical impossibility that we are the only planet that has living life, or you believe it's magic. That's
unlikelihood.
I don't buy that. But I'd love to hear what you think. You can email us science@newstalk.com. Is it possible for a third option? Maybe it is. We were speaking about Tilda with the brilliant Roseanne Kenny, who was talking about this longitudinal Irish study that has been watching how Irish people age and learning from that, doing really, really careful measurements. It's really interesting. Patter has emailed in saying, always love listening to Roseanne, particularly as I just hit north of 59 as a male. Are Tilda still taking people into the study? Keen to make a contribution. Tugabugge. So you can email Tilda at tcd.ie and find out about pilot studies, but in terms of the main longitudinal study, because it started so many years ago, they replenish some, but they're not actively looking for members of the main study. But you can take part in pilot studies. So they figure out what to include in future questionnaires and so on. So you can help.
Yeah, and they don't take volunteers for the main study because it's by its nature random. Supposed to be random, random selection, right. A representative selection of the population.
Okay, that's what it is. Yeah, okay. Also, in News Round, we talked about 2 to 3 cups of coffee being quite good for you.
Yeah, so yeah, it was definitely, because I remember going slightly less than I take. So yeah, it was 2 to 3, 3 to 4, but over 4, you're getting into kind of.
I can't remember what the actual benefit was, but there's a number of studies that suggest this, right?
So, yeah, it was kind of. Better health outcomes generally, like better muscle mass, less.
It was a complicated study.
Yeah, types of fats in the liver and different types of fats. That type of thing.
Someone has texted in saying, did the study distinguish between caffeinated and decaf? I think people would assume that if someone's having 4 cups of coffee a day, it's not decaf coffee. Like, you don't have 4 cups of decaf coffee a day and call yourself someone who drinks 4 cups of coffee a day. Like, you would just say, no, I drink coffee. I mean, like, right?
Yeah, like, it's like doing research. If you were doing research on beer, you wouldn't pick non-alcoholic beer. If you're doing research on alcoholism, it's like, it's a defining factor of coffee that you have caffeine.
Yeah, exactly. I would say it would be weird to do that.
Yeah.
But thanks for the question. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, Hugo De Silva, Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.